Blog Talk Radio.
I'm sick of that song. You sick of it? You good?
You chose it. It was your choice.
All right, and welcome to the Matthew Aaron Show. I am Matthew Aaron, www.thematthewaaronshow.com, at Matt Aaron Show on Twitter. You can go to Facebook in the search bar, type the Matthew Aaron Show, and click like, and you will be one of our legion of fans over at the Matthew Aaron Show on Stitcher. You can go to the Matthew Aaron Show, listen to us there. You can also listen to other podcasts as well and the news. You can listen to your BBC and then the Matthew Aaron Show. That's perfect, right? No, BBC is more important than us, trust me.
Yeah. We're not going to pretend we are more important than the BBC. American News One Networks, maybe. But
Lee Caprae, say hello.
Hello, Lee Caprae.
There you go. Yes. There you go. You want to do your Twitter little thing?
Yeah, at Lee Caprae at Twitter.
Yeah, your little Twitter thing. What else is going on? Where else can you find? Oh, there's Josephine. And we're here at 603 North Hollywood Way, Tay, Chicago, here in Burbank. Arlene and Joe Montagna, very, very thankful and gracious to have us yet again. Come on by, have a mini deep dish. It's pretty phenomenal. You'll sleep for a week, but it's really good.
You'll sleep sitting erect.
Yes, that's exactly right. We're about to have a Neil Bear. This is a big deal for me. We've tried to get Neil on for a while. Of course, everyone knows I'm a massive ER fan. I'm a massive Law & Order fan. So this is just kind of like Nirvana for me.
Finally
I didn't have to do a lot of research.
We've tracked down the wily and elusive Neil.
Yes, and he has a new show that's currently out on CBS on Monday nights. It's going to be its third episode next Monday. They've already aired the first two. It's a Stephen King novel brought to life on television, and that is Under the Dome. And I remember I read the pilot for this thing months before it came out, and I thought, this is going to be a really good show. And it is a really good show. So I'm very excited to talk Under the Dome. Also, Matthew Cook, I did an interview with him last week, How to Make Money Selling Drugs, is his documentary.
Right.
And we will be playing
very
that interview.
Very interesting movie.
We will be playing that interview after we are done speaking with Neil. I think we should get right into it and talk to Neil. Though, real quick, you and I were having a conversation before the show. The number one selling GameCube game. What do you think it was?
Well, my pick was Smash Brothers.
You're right.
Melee.
But not by a lot.
Not by a lot?
By 90,000 units, it beat Mario Kart Double Dash.
Yes.
And then number three was their big game that opened for GameCube, which we forgot about, Super Mario Sunshine.
Sunshine, yeah.
Sunshine, because it was awful.
It was not a good game.
No, it's no good.
But we were talking about, when we got those new systems, they made all those did is made us play the old systems more.
Yep.
When we got the 64, I just wound up playing the SNES more.
Yep.
And but the SNES had five staple games when they came out that were fantastic, which was the Mario 64, Link, GoldenEye, Zelda, Ocarina of Time, and Turok, the Dinosaur Hunter. Those were their launcher games. And I still wound up going back and play the SNES games more.
Your useless knowledge astounds me.
Yes. The more useless the knowledge is, the more I have of it.
I'm not going to be mean. All right, Neil's here with us. Neil Bear, how are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I don't know if you've heard the show before, but you're
I have.
Okay. Well, then, let me tell you. We do kind of a long interview here. We're going to go through your career, because I'm a big fan of your career. You know Neil is an MD.
That's right. I'm a
Harvard
pediatrician.
Medical School.
Really?
Yeah, I'm a pediatrician, so don't ask me any questions about yourselves.
Yeah, right.
Right.
I went to my pediatrician until I was like 20.
Yeah, that happens more and
like,
more now.
Listen, I really need you to leave, Matt. I got kids.
Adolescence ends at 30 now.
Yeah. He didn't ask me to leave. I had to convince my mother because I thought it was weird because I'd go to the pediatrician's office, be all these little kids and me, and I'd still leave with the sucker. And I had to convince my mother, I gotta get another doctor. And she was, I think it was just her being lazy. She totally just didn't want to go through those motions. But yeah, and I finally got another doctor. But I literally went to my pediatrician until I was 20, which is kind of the equivalent to sucking on your mom's tit till you're 7 or 8.
Yeah.
Is that right?
I mean, you were like literally sitting on an undersized like chair. Like he was just like.
Is that like a new phenomenon though, Neil? The breastfeeding till you're like 8 or 9.
Oh, it's so weird.
Yeah, you know.
Did you have that?
Did I have it?
Yeah,
no, not personally, but there are a lot of kids who nurse for more than 1 or 2 years.
I'd love to see the effect
on demand too. That's what's really weird. Right. Up to their mothers and they just like open her blouse. You know, it's like as they. You know, I have seen that. It's a little weird.
Oh, you've seen that because you live in L.A. Let's just be honest. That's just an L.A. thing.
Oh, I'll never be able to use Comcast On Demand again without thinking of that.
How much different? Because you were in New York for, what is it, 9 years with Law & Order?
11 on SVU.
11. It was 11. So you were there from, what, your season 1 to season 12?
Season 10 through season 11. Season 2 through season 11.
Okay, it was 2 through 11. So you were in New York for years. For you, as a guy who's a veteran of ER with Chicago, SVU's New York, under the dome you're doing in Carolina, but you live in L.A., what are the differences of these places you film at? Which is your favorite? Like, give us the differences mainly between New York and L.A.
Well, I'd rather shoot in L.A. simply because the writers and the editors are here.
Yeah, everyone.
And so when we did ER at Warner Brothers, it was just like walking a block from our office to Stage 11. So you could really be more involved.
Yeah.
With SVU, you'd have to fly 6 hours, to get to New York. And then, it was a hassle. So, I mean, I love shooting in New York. That's great. And, New York was really a character on SVU.
Yeah.
But it's just not, unless you want to move there. And every year I would say, I'm going to move, and I'll move all the writers to New York. And then my son was in middle school. My son was in high school. Then he graduated, and now he's in college in Massachusetts. So if I had stayed on SVU, maybe I would have moved at some point.
Warren Light now runs SVU
Warren
and
does,
doing
yeah.
a great job.
Yeah, yeah. Going in its 15th year. I'm very lucky. Like, ER was on for 15 years.
Yeah.
SVU is starting its 15th year.
Can Under the Dome do 15?
Easily.
Easily? It's a big book. It's a big book.
The book only lasts for like a week. Yeah. We're already on day 13.
The book is interesting because I feel like there are some things in the book that obviously will be very difficult to get past network censors. Do you feel that way?
Well, I think, our show is psychologically dark. So, yeah, we don't have F-bombs. we don't have nudity.
Right.
At least frontal. We have women's backs. On broadcast network.
Okay.
But not below their back.
Backs are sensual. Backs,
you know, it was really good. It was funny. We got a note that you know, they like look at it frame by frame just to make sure that see something.
Just,
so
we
amazing.
Just have to confirm.
They were like me when I was 11. Yeah. I have to look frame by frame at Madeline Stowe's ass.
That's
in
right.
Stakeout.
That's right.
What are you doing in there? My homework.
Well,
exactly.
That's fascinating. So Under the Dome. Let's talk about how this project came to be, and then we'll get back into your whole career and everything. We'll try to tie it all in together. But Under the Dome, this is Steven Spielberg. This is Stephen King.
Double Stevens, yeah.
Yeah, Double Stevens and yourself. And tell me how this project came about, how everything just kind of came together, because people are comparing it to shows like Revolution and Lost when, funny enough, this book has been around, you know,
much longer, or
much
the Simpsons
longer.
Movie,
or the Simpsons movie.
But we'll
right.
you'll see in episode 3 that we actually cite the Simpsons movie.
You do,
sure, because Stephen King was working on the show, or on the book, I should say, for, I don't know, 20 some odd years or 30 years. So he had it going for a long time, put it away, came back to it, and so it was, you know, just, you know, kind of a coincidence that the Simpsons movie came out when it did, and Stephen's book did, because Stephen did it many years before. But that's not a new concept, you know. There were plays like No Exit by Sartre. There was a Twilight Zone show. You know,
there was a Twilight Zone.
It's not unusual for people to be trapped. That's kind of a great thing. We trap people in the ER, you know.
Yeah, right, right.
You know, you want to trap people
usually
in some place.
Every season finale, you trap
exactly.
them in the ER.
That's right, exactly. So it started, Brian K. Vaughan, who's a phenomenal graphic novelist who did Why the Man and worked on Lost, wrote the first episode over 2 years ago for Showtime. And Steven Spielberg's company, Amblin Television, bought the rights to the book, and they had Brian write the first episode, the pilot, and Showtime had it for quite a long time, and then ultimately last fall, decided not to go with it.
Right.
You know, and they were going in a different direction, the kind of shows they're going to do. And so Nina Tassler, who's the president of CBS Television, read the script and right away said, this fits perfectly with our plan for summer. We were looking for a show to do that has kind of a popcorn feel to it, and yet is about something that could be done in 13 weeks and uninterrupted, no repeats, could be serialized so that you don't have to make the long commitment to a 22 to 25 episode series like you did on ER, for instance, which was serialized. People don't have the time anymore because they're doing social networking, they're doing their email, et cetera. So they're watching cable. They have many, many more choices than we did on ER. So it just kind of fit within all the parameters that Nina was looking for, and she said, let's do it. And let's do it this summer. So we started right in November and started casting it and shot it starting at the end of this past February.
So were you involved in the Showtime version of the project?
No, I was involved in the project right when it was bought by CBS because I have a deal at CBS.
You have a deal there.
And so I took it on and we trimmed it because it was longer at Showtime.
Right.
Took out any drug use.
Okay.
And any F-bombs, but very, very little did we take out.
Drugs is a pretty decent, you know, plot of this novel. Is this something that you're still going to be able to do on network TV?
Sure.
I mean, you've done it on Law and Order and ER.
Sure.
I mean, you've done it on both those shows.
Oh, yeah.
There's been drug.
Oh, yeah.
Neil can do whatever he wants on CBS. Yeah. He's got Drive On and everything.
No, I can't. But it's really about showing, you know, showing kids smoking marijuana and stuff like that. So we don't do that. But
is the drug dealing storyline still going to be involved with the show? Or are you allowed to talk about
possibly.
It?
Possibly.
Okay. Because there is going to be some deviations from the book, right?
Sure.
Sure.
There has to be.
Sure.
Yeah.
Is Stephen King somebody that you've ran these deviations by? Is he involved to that degree?
Yeah, he came to North Carolina when we were shooting the pilot, and he came 2 weeks ago when we showed the premiere, you know, a couple days before it premiered on television, and he got the key to the city. It was really cool in Wilmington. He's really a lovely guy.
Wilmington's beautiful, right?
It's right on the water. We shoot there. We shoot in a couple other little towns and stitch them together to make our fictional town.
And it's Maine.
No, it's not Maine. It's anywhere USA.
Oh, anywhere USA.
Yeah,
okay.
And it's...
The book is Maine,
The book
though,
is
right?
Maine because that's where Stephen lives. And he's been really supportive. He reads all the scripts, looks at all the cuts, asks us really good questions.
Is he very particular about what choices you're making, or does he let you have free reign as long as you're kind of going with the spirit of the writing?
Yeah, very much free reign. He's collaborative and feels that he did his part in writing the book, and he actually wrote a piece that was in Entertainment Weekly, I think, last week to all the fans who said they didn't follow every iota of the book the way that we expected. And Stephen said, yeah, because that's the book. You can read it over if you want to see it.
Right, right.
And
neither did Jaws. Neither did Jurassic Park.
Or
neither did
Walking Dead.
Right, right.
So,
right.
But maybe Game of Thrones does more. But,
sure.
But that's okay. So
except for all the food.
Right, right.
Half of Game of Thrones is about food.
So we give people, you know, we thought that maybe the fans would embrace it. And I think they, you know, many of them are, because you'll get something new. It's like you think you know what's going to happen, and then it takes a little turn because we are different from the book.
I think part of the reason your ratings were so good for the premiere and still really, really good for the second episode is I think you've definitely captured the vision of this show. Who's involved, or the book, who's involved in the visual concept of the show? Because visually, when I read the book and I watch the pilot and I watch the second episode, I said to myself, this is pretty much how I saw it.
Well, it's certainly a collaborative effort. That's where Steven Spielberg comes in, because if you want to work with the two Stevens of popular culture, I mean, who comes to mind? Spielberg and King.
Yeah, sure.
So we've talked to Spielberg a lot about the look of the show, you know, down to the color tone.
Right. The color tone.
Special effects, you know, the kinds of shooting, handheld, when we do dollies, when we do Steadicam, all of that. And that's Steven's, certainly, wow. Obviously, Steven's purview. And so we work with him, and we run a lot of things by him. And then, you know, the writers really embrace what the book's tone, visual tone is and was. And then we work with Jack Bender, who was the directing producer of Lost.
Yeah.
You always want a directing producer who is good with itinerant actors. You know, he was good with those actors in Hawaii. So, you know, when you have actors and you need to, like, rein them in, you go to Jack Bender. But our actors are really, really lovely people, and they're really close. It's like, it's kind of like what I remember on ER when we first started, when there was Noah and George and Tony, Eric, yeah. Sherry and Juliana, the first season, yeah. That they were really tight. Well, all of our actors, Mike Vogel and Rochelle Lefebvre and Dean Norris and Alex Koch and Britt Robertson, Natalie Martinez, Colin Ford, really tight too. And so
right.
It
and
just makes
Law
a
and
big
Order
difference.
Was like that too. You always hear about
Mariska,
Post Malone and Mariska.
Well, Mariska and Chris were the longest reigning couple team
right.
In TV history for a drama. They were only beaten by Ozzy and Harriet for comedy.
Wow.
But Mariska and Chris were together for 12 years.
And Chris and Belzer are really close.
Chris,
I mean,
and Belzer,
Ice-T,
and
yeah,
Dan Florek.
Sure.
It was weird, you know. I remember
Dan Florek's great.
He's fantastic. He's great. And nice guy. They're all really nice,
yeah.
Nice people. And I remember in the last year I was there, which was year 12.
And Maloney left the same time,
same time, right? Yeah, at the end of year 12. That I remember when I was looking at the credits, and there was Chris and Mariska and Ice and Belzer, Dan, and Stephanie March.
Yeah, Stephanie March.
Like, I said to Stephanie, I said, this was exactly the same as the day I came on in 2000.
Yeah.
In 2000, and I left in 2011.
It kind of
wow, that's never happened in TV. It's like the same cast. It was weird. Now, there had been changes, and people came and went.
Sure, Diane Neal and BD Wong was a regular, and then
Tamara Tooney.
Yeah.
But that group, from the moment I came on, well, Tooney and BD were still
They're still there.
Yeah,
recurring,
so
yeah.
You would never see that, you know, again, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's great. You did great things with that show,
and
too.
The guest stars were just, that's also been really fun.
Amazing.
For me. Because
yeah, you had big
SVU,
big guest stars.
Huge guest stars. Yeah.
And then, you know, we just had, then I will pull from SVU for Under the Dome, so we just had Mayor Winningham on.
Yeah, I
and
saw
so
that,
like,
yeah.
And, you know, it's like, and I worked with her on ER, too, so I've been able to pull really great actors from my experience.
All three of those shows you worked on, great guest stars.
Great.
I mean, every year.
Six Emmys. We had five Emmys for guest stars, six in a row because Mrshka won 1 year on SVU. I think it was a record for a series.
And don't forget, ER, too. Every year someone got nominated for a guest
but they didn't
a
win.
Guest starring role. No.
But they won, though.
Didn't one year someone won, though, for ER, right, for a guest spot?
Oh, a lot. Sally Field when I did it.
Yeah, Sally Field.
I think Ray Liotta did.
Ray Liotta, that's right.
But
Ray
Sally won when I was on. Lots of nominations, but...
Did Jimmy Woods win the year he did it on ER, too?
No, I don't think
no,
so.
No, he didn't?
No.
He was nominated, though.
No.
I remember that.
Yeah.
He
but
was
we had,
great, too.
We had... One year we had three out of the five. We had Carol Burnett, Ellen Burstyn, and Brenda Blethyn, and Ellen won.
Yeah.
And it was like one year we had Amanda Plummer and Angela Lansbury, and we thought Angela was going to win because it was her 19th nomination, and Amanda Plummer won.
You know who should have won for ER in the guest?
Who?
Bob Newhart.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was Bob's three episodes.
I love
he
Bob.
Did for ER.
And
so
Alan
great.
Alda. Alan Alda, too.
Was great. Yet, like I said, Jimmy Woods was great when he was on. I say this to people all the time, and I know what you're saying about serialized shows, and I see what Nina's saying, and I think it's totally accurate to it. Well, I think it's pretty accurate. But I will tell you this. ER is one of those shows that, unfortunately, you don't really see in syndication because they're afraid no one's watching it because it's serialized. It's a great show. ER is one of the best shows I've ever seen in my life.
Thanks.
And by the way, it does not ever, ever... You think every season when someone big would leave, you'd be like, this is the year that it's over.
Right.
And you guys did a great job of bringing in new people. Mekhi Phifer was fantastic. People I would have never expected to be
Maura
good.
Maura Tierney.
Right. Maura Tierney. Maura Visnjic's great. Right. Just John Stamos. I thought Stamos was going to come on and be fucking terrible. And he was great.
That was after I left. But
you brought
I
it.
The
right.
first 7 years. But I worked with Stamos on SVU.
Yeah,
hey,
you did.
When Stamos
did.
Wants to bring
he
the Thunder.
He played a scumbag on SVU.
He does not
he was
F
great.
Around.
No, he doesn't.
No, he
for CBS,
he
does not F around.
He plays a serial.
Oh, it's so
like,
great. God, you really know it. It's like,
oh,
that's
yeah.
when I brought
is
Laurie Singer back.
The
from,
biggest
from,
nut for the show.
From Footloose.
Yep.
And she played one of his many paramours. Yes. He had like 40 children.
He puts holes in condoms. He puts holes in condoms and bangs all these women.
And he has
like
all these
children
because
yeah.
he just liked kids.
Yeah, right.
Oh, wow.
And that was based on
a real,
real
story.
Really crazy.
Yeah.
And he was like so likable. It's like, yeah, I love kids. And you're just
Stamos
like,
was really
whoa,
good.
This is really screwed up.
And at no point did he overact
no,
or anything.
Just
he
like, which
really
made it worse.
This guy that was like really in the
It gym. Made it more shocking. Like
yeah.
he just didn't see what was wrong with that.
Right. Right. It was a really good performance by him. That was really fascinating.
That was Stamos?
Yeah. He's really grown as an actor on me. Like a lot.
He's doing
a
pilot.
Lot.
He did a pilot. I see
Victor.
that might still go.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I heard. They re-optioned the cast for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk more about Under the Dome, though. Okay, so the first two episodes you have here, Dean Norris, of course, I think is the lead of this show, you would say, right?
Well, he and Mike and Rochelle, the three of them.
Sure. You used a casting director who I'm very familiar with, who has done this show, is Sharon Bialy.
Sharon and Sherry Thomas.
And Sherry Thomas, both of them fantastic. I noticed there are a lot of Breaking Bad people on the show. There's a lot of people from Law and Order that have been on the show. In the casting process, when you're casting a show, do you have people in mind from years ago that maybe you've never used or you used one time on a show and it just sticks in your mind? You go, I really want to work with them and this role would be great for them.
Yeah.
Is that how it works?
Yeah, I think with Dean it was Sharon and Sherry because they cast Breaking Bad and
right.
they cast Walking Dead recently. So they said, Dean is perfect. We know Dean will be available.
Right.
And he'll be on Sunday nights and Monday nights this summer, you know, doing Breaking Bad on Sunday and our show on Monday. Mike, we saw lots and lots of young actors and just really thought Mike was the best. Rochelle, I worked with on A Gifted Man last year.
Right, with
so
Patrick
I said,
Wilson,
with Patrick
who I
Wilson
love.
And Margot
Martindale.
And so I said, Rochelle just is this part. So that was, we didn't really see people. We just offered Rochelle. Then we saw lots of people. When Alex Koch came in, Alex, this was his first interview ever. He came from college, and we were blown away. And, you know, we took him to the studio and they loved him. And then we took him to the network and he had to do it like three times because, you know, it is a big risk when you don't know this person's work. All you
sure.
can see is what's there. But I said that, you know, when we did SVU that we had Patricia Rooney on in her first episode, a.k.a. Rooney Mara.
Rooney
was
Mara.
Patricia
Rooney
Mara. Her name was Patricia Mara back then, so she became Rooney Mara. Or Matthew Pitt, or Abigail Breslin, or all these, or Sarah Hyland, who's on Modern Family.
Yeah.
Nobody knew these kids when we were working with them, but we thought they were really phenomenal actors. And so you can kind of tell, and with Alex, we felt that way. Now, a lot of people are like going, whoa, he plays Junior, he's really freaky.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, what you see is not off, is not always what you will ultimately get.
Star power really isn't that important anymore, I don't
know.
No,
I think you just want like a cast that coheres. And when you asked me that question, I always thought of Samantha Mathis for the role of Alice,
yeah,
one of the mothers.
Great.
And Samantha did the 100th episode of SVU with Jacqueline Bisset, and so playing her daughter. And I always loved Samantha's movies. And so I kind of, when we were casting those parts, I said, Samantha. Perfect.
That's great. So yeah, you just
so you do think of people.
So it's right. It's more writing so much as what actors you have, and then you have you always are going to get good actors.
I think so, right?
Because they're gravitated to good writing.
Your biggest star in ER was Anthony Edwards,
right?
And he wasn't that big of a star.
No,
at
he
the
was
time.
Goose.
Right, he was Goose. That's it. And Law and Order, no one was really a big name.
Mariska
maybe
had been
Ice
on.
T
had been on ER,
cred.
Yeah. But Maloney had been on NYPD Blue,
right?
Blues, but. But Mariska had been on ER and some comedies. But
so you don't always need...
You never know.
Yeah, I don't really think star power is that big of a deal.
No.
And by the way, there's so many stars now going to TV whose pilots aren't getting even picked
or
up.
Or whose shows don't last.
They're no good, yeah.
To name that.
Right, so. Right. And so I think that's great that you go out and you get a guy who... Fresh out of college. Because who cares?
Yeah, and you've never seen
really?
Him, so you like want to know. Like people are like, wow, I don't know about this guy. Is he really crazy?
No, people,
is he really bad?
People who run testing markets care.
How
they
do you feel about that, though, testing?
Oh, the dial test?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's really, it's scary, you know. You're like in there and you're seeing these people in Las Vegas turn the knobs, and it's like, whoa, you know.
Another Las Vegas.
Yeah.
I think all the testing happens in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Or Reno.
Las Vegas, the sharpest and least impaired of all people. Come on.
So, a lovely place.
So yes. When you go to these testing things, though, have you ever gotten a testing? Have you ever gotten testing back? Because I know you did. You were running a couple pilots that didn't go with CBS before you did Under the Dome.
Right.
So when you would get testing back on those pilots that ended up not going, was it testing you tended to agree with, or were you like,
this
is bullshit?
It's so hard. I think it's hard to tell, but you can see trends and things that
yeah.
you know what people like or don't like. Though ER tested really well and. It did really well, even though, you know, the lore is that the network did not like it. But Nina and Les loved it because they were running
yeah.
Warner Brothers then.
So Under the Dome, is this something – yeah, Les gets a lot of credit for ER.
He should because
yes.
he's the one who pushed it through.
And is it true, since I have you here and you got all the ER info, is it true from what you know that Les is the one that really wanted George Clooney? Like he wanted to have a George Clooney show?
I think that's true, yeah.
Yeah, I've always heard that Les really believed in George
yeah.
and like really wanted to make him a star.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's fascinating.
And you see what happened.
Yeah, it worked out. Okay.
But it always, you know, if you have a character who plays a pediatrician and a womanizer, you can't go wrong. He loves kids and he loves women.
Yeah.
You know?
How much did you add to ER with your pediatrician background?
Tons at all the medical
So
places.
This was like a big break
you know, kids
for you, even though you wrote
kids
before
peed and
it.
Puked on me, and that's what they did to Noah Wiley. But a lot of the ethical dilemmas I faced, I did a show for George in year two where he saved this kid in a tunnel. I never saved a kid in a tunnel. But in year three, I did a show with George and Clea DuVall, Veronica Cartwright, and Chad Lindbergh, who's done a lot of movies, and Clea certainly has.
Yeah.
And
I had the biggest crush on Clea DuVall.
Yeah,
Clea's
DuVall,
great.
Yeah.
Clea's great. And Veronica was in the movie The Birds, and she was in the Sigourney Weaver. She spit out the cherry pit. Not is it Alien? Is that what she was in? I think yeah.
Oh yeah.
So
Alien.
So that's like my favorite ER, and that was inspired. That was about a kid who wanted to be allowed to die, but who was underage.
Yeah.
And it was a real turning point episode for George Clooney, and that was inspired by something that happened to me. So I found that when I drew on these really tough cases, they made for really good shows on ER.
So you had to draw more on case studies from, like, medical history than your own experiences?
No,
or
both,
was it both?
Both,
yeah.
both.
Yeah, it was both.
Both.
Let me ask you, working with John Wells.
Yeah.
I really think he is really brilliant. I think he's great. How much do you learn from a guy like John Wells, or are you guys more like contemporaries together, where you get together and you both have great ideas?
Well,
and
we're
stuff,
contemporaries because we, you know how we met, right?
No, I don't know the story with you and John Wells.
We grew up 6 blocks away from each other and went to the same elementary school in Denver, Colorado.
Really?
So when people say, how do you break into the business? I say, it isn't by writing spec scripts. It's
go to school with John Wells.
Okay. Yeah, he was always the stage manager of all the plays we did in high school. So I went to school in the Cherry Creek School District in Denver, Colorado, and John and I went to Holly Hills Elementary School together. And he and I have been friends. I've been friends with his two siblings, his parents, for many years, since we were 9. And so when I was out here after film school at AFI, I ran into John in a grocery store. Literally, our carts like almost hit. And we said, hey, what are you doing? And it's like, oh, I just got out of AFI, and I'm trying to direct writing and directing an after-school special for ABC. What are you doing? He goes, oh, I'm doing China Beach.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, I'd love to like get into, you know, dramatic television, you know, as well. And he goes, okay, well, come by. So I came by, and he gave me a script, and that's how I got started. And I wrote a script for China Beach.
Can we know John Wells?
Yeah, is John still in school? And if so,
yeah, right.
Where at?
Right. Where at? We have the money to
He just directed August Osage.
Yep, with George.
And then, so what's really great is, so I did
Tracy
China
Letts.
Beach. That's right.
Tracy Letts, yeah.
I did China Beach. I got nominated for Writers Guild Award. I lost to John Sacred Young, who ran the show, thank God, because you don't want to like
beat
the showrunner. And then I said, my son was born. I was getting a little antsy. I don't know if I'm going to make it. John and I sold a pilot to NBC. I still was like freaking out. I said, I got to go back to school. So I went to medical school. So my wife and son and I moved back to Boston, went to Harvard Medical School, fourth year medical student, get a call from John. Neil, I got this script that was found in a trunk, literally, in Spielberg's office. Spielberg's owned it for, I don't know how many years. Michael Crichton wrote it in 1969 when he was at Harvard Medical School. This is now 1994, 25 years later. Read it. See what you think. I read it. Boom. I said, John, it's like my life, only we don't have those antibiotics anymore, and we don't use glass IV bottles. He said, well, if it goes, the network hates it. But if it goes, because Michael and Steven are attached, will you work on it with us? Because we want real stories, want real life. I said, I'm there. I'm only $150,000 in debt from medical school. Sure, bring me in. Okay. So I went there in May of 1994.
Just that for inflation.
Yeah, 1994 in May. Go there. I remember it so clearly, going to the Warner Brothers lot. And I just fell in love with the show. I was supposed to be there for 2 months. I went to John and I said, John, I'm loving this. Can I stay? And he goes, Neil, you can stay. There are no guarantees. This was in August. The show hadn't premiered. He said, you know, we may be on for a couple of weeks. And then I said, that's okay, because Harvard will say, you know, you can come back whenever you want.
Sure.
So it was the best decision I ever made.
Wow.
The show took off like unbelievably, you know, the highest rated show in the last 30 years.
Yeah.
And I stayed for 7 years, and I went back and forth to Boston to medical school during hiatuses. And then I did my residency at Children's Hospital LA over 7 years. I used to hide in the closet and give notes on SVU. And the nurse would, like, open the door to get, like, some bandages, and she'd say, what are you doing? And I'd say, just close the door. So it's like, leave me alone. So I'd go, like, one time I was doing a rotation at County USC. I was, like, poking little babies for blood from 4 a.m. to 7 a.m. And then I'd race to Venice to do my pilot called Outreach with Rob Estes, Keith Carradine, and Meen Na. And then we'd shoot, and then I'd race to ER in Burbank, and then I'd go to sleep for a few hours, and I'd be back at County USC, and I look, and then I'd do my call nights on the weekend when we weren't shooting, so I'd trade with everybody. Everybody wanted me to take their weekend call, and I can remember sleeping in this like room that was like 10 feet by 6 feet in a bunk bed, and there were roaches everywhere, and it's in the hospital, but I'm sure they've cleaned it up by now, and thinking, what am I doing? But that was only for a month. I made it.
I bitch about my schedule tiring me out.
I don't know how I did it.
That is one of my favorite stories I've ever heard on the show. Not only that, we were just talking outside about all these people that claim they're ambitious and shit.
Right.
This is that's ambitious.
That's really
that.
Yeah.
is ambition. That is owning yourself. That is looking in a mirror. That's doing, you know, that is taking responsibility for yourself.
Well,
that's
no,
great.
People's ambition today might match that in energy, but they also have to let you know how hard
right.
they're working.
He
and
didn't
how
have
tough
time
it
to
is.
He didn't have time to lay.
And
no.
how tough it is.
I would just still get stories. I mean, crazy things happen.
How do you balance the personal life with that kind
well,
of schedule?
Well, my son said to me
time.
when he was 11, when I finally finished, he goes, oh, you know, Dad, you've been on call my whole life. I was like, oh, I better change
when
that.
When he's dropping the jargon on you, you're
he
in trouble.
He came in to use the bathroom and you were asleep standing up in the shower right. while writing down ideas.
So you were doing the Noah Wiley on the pilot-y or the three-hour naps before, you know, that's all you would get.
Power
like,
naps.
Right. They would do the doctors that do the power naps.
Yeah,
which, by the way, when I watched the pilot of ER and I saw that the doctors get like three-hour power naps, I'm like, you know, I don't know if that's so good.
But that's changed. You know, since even since I finished in 2001 or 2, now there are laws where you can't go for more than, I think, 32 hours or something like that.
Okay.
You cannot. I mean, I would, like, go at 5 in the morning, be on call that night, admit 16 children onto the ward, lose my mind, pray, have all the other kids on the ward, do dictation.
Then coffee
not
break.
Finish, no coffee break. No
really?
Sleeping in the.
How much
anywhere.
Coffee do you drink? Do you, were
I
you
still
big?
Drink a lot, yeah.
Yeah, man, I got to imagine.
And then, and then you would like talk to like, you'd always like have some weird person who'd show up in the middle of the night. Like, I remember there's this woman. No, this is a good story. I remember there's this woman who would try to sell, really young and cute, try to sell us insurance as residents when I was a resident. That became Julie Bowen on ER.
Really?
Wow!
Yeah, of course. One of her first roles based on this woman who would like because she would get us like when we were very vulnerable, you know, sleep deprived, and come in look great and say you really need like life insurance. Like okay, whatever you say.
He kept running into the same two identical twin girls standing in the hallway who told him to come play with them, and they had a script for him.
Yeah. That became. She became one of Noah Wiley's flings on ER.
That's right. That's wow. right.
Oh, Julie man. Bowen.
That's right.
That's a great story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, that's a crazy life.
We had crazy.
I
had a patient who was had Alzheimer's and was an opera singer, and she would walk down the hall singing, but she didn't remember her name. It was really striking, sad, but powerful that she could still sing and she felt
so
alive.
That's the inspiration. That became
Rosemary
right,
Clooney.
Right.
Who. But she just became a jazz singer on the show, and I'll never forget when she was on the show. I wrote an episode for her, and she cleared the whole set so she could record her song, "Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas." I wrote the first Christmas episode of ER in 1994, and I'll never forget that she. I started to walk out. She said, "Oh no, you're staying," and she took out a little pitch pipe, and then she sang to me. She said, "I need an audience," and I was just like melting. She also would say, "Neil, watch this," and she'd put her hand out, and she'd say, "George." Water. And he'd like run and give her a glass of water. George, I'm hungry. Could you get me something? And she'd put her hand out and he'd bring her a plate. He was so sweet to her. He really was devoted to her.
That's
yeah.
really great.
He was he's a nice guy.
That's really, really great. Wow.
But she liked to make him run. She said, I'm the only one who can do this, which was true.
That's great. So do you kind of feel like now you've been separated from ER for years, you did Law and Order SVU, now you're doing Under the Dome, and Under the Dome is because you didn't start on SVU, you came in
year two.
So I mean that, and that's a Dick Wolf show,
right?
This right now on CBS. Yes, it's Stephen King, Steven Spielberg, but this is your show.
Yep,
this is from Inception.
Yep.
Do you see yourself? You're going to stick with this show as long.
Yeah,
as possible?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I love the cast. It just makes me so happy that we're doing, you know. Well, right now, you never know what's going to happen, but the cast is just, they're such nice people. Rochelle's worked in so many shows, done really great work.
Yeah.
She's so talented. I'm so happy
I'm
for her.
I'm excited about the Mayor Whittingham.
Mayor is, too. Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
Mayor
great.
Is, Mayor works with Dean, and it's great.
That's great.
And so it's really gratifying. We've got fantastic writers. I haven't worked with any of the, well, Dan Truly I worked with on Gifted Man and SVU, and he came in for about 11 weeks this season. But all the other writers I've never worked with before, and it's been really fun to work with a whole new group of people.
What do you think didn't work with The Gifted Man? You have a great cast. I mean, I think Patrick Wilson's one of the most underrated guys in the
business. Oh, so talented.
Margo Martindale's amazing.
Margo is a hoot.
Yeah.
A hoot.
So what happened? What do you think was...
What was on 8 o'clock on Friday night?
Yeah.
But you know what's interesting? Yeah, so there's no lead-in. But you know what's interesting is it did better... The year it was on, than this year's shows,
yeah,
and so much better. So you just never know, but you have to let that go, and you just move on to the next thing. So if it had done pretty well, then I wouldn't be doing Under the Dome.
That's true. That's a good point. And by the way, I did want to ask you though also about Gifted Man. You really enjoyed working with Patrick Wilson, though.
Patrick's so talented.
He's the greatest. Yeah,
I mean he's really deeply talented. I have a feeling that. His new film, The Conjurer, is going to be big.
I hear it's very good, actually.
Yep, really good.
And Vera Farmiga is in it, and his wife as well. And James Wan directed it.
Yep.
And I've actually heard very good things about it. And he's filming Stretch right now with a friend of ours, Joe Carnahan.
You mean The Conjuring?
The Conjuring. Yeah,
Conjuring.
Over at Warner Brothers.
That was something else.
And they're filming Stretch right now. Patrick starring in it with Chris Pine. And
nice.
I think tons of people are in it. I forget who else is in it. But Carnahan is doing that. What I think is interesting, and Cesar had a good question I want to ask you, but to lead into that, you're doing 13 episodes instead of 22.
We're on number 13. I'm so happy.
Oh, really? So this is it. You're like
wrapping
it up. I know
all the secrets.
You're wrapping it up.
We are wrapping it up.
You can't give away any secrets.
I can't give away any secrets.
It's like Breaking
Bad.
Yeah.
That's right.
I hear from Sharon Bialy.
I don't want secrets given away.
Well, no.
I don't want to know what happens on Breaking Bad ahead of time.
I twist Betsy Brandt's arm to give me like pre-spoilers.
Yeah.
Not like the actual spoiler, but give me a pre-spoiler when I hang out with Betsy. I'll try to lure her into it with our friendship,
But
too.
You're not doing it to get the answers. You're just doing it
for
fun.
No, I
want
to know the plot lines or something,
to like,
you know?
To see what she'll do.
So my thing is, you got 13 episodes. Okay. And they're in the can as of this last one here, which is great. Revolution. This is a show that had 22 episodes, but they split it up. They split it into chunks, and they lost viewers because of it. Do you think that this is a much... If Revolution did 22 straight, it's a lot easier
it
to keep
easier.
A fan
sure.
base?
Sure. We have 13 in a row. We repeat on Sunday nights, which, at least for the time being. So I know like this Sunday we're on again. But 13 in a row, no repeats. You can commit. You can binge if you want on Amazon.
Yeah, right.
We prefer you commit to 10 o'clock, but if you want to binge, you can binge. You can use different platforms like, you know, the Amazon platform, which is really great. And, you know, people, we just have to acknowledge and accept that people are watching in ways very different from when I did China Beach.
Right, or
you know,
ER.
Or
even.
ER,
right.
When you saw it, and then you could see the repeat. And then you could kind of get it on beta, and you could get it on, you know, VHS, then you get on DVDs, and then you can get it online. And
so why is the live number so important to you guys still?
Well, I think the live number plus three
is
really
three,
important.
The DVR,
Because that's when people are really watching the, you know,
I don't think people know that, though, that if you keep it on your DVR for like 2 weeks, it won't count towards
the
number.
It doesn't
help Neil.
Plus seven.
Yeah,
plus seven.
No, but if you give it up for 2 weeks, you're you're screwed.
But we only do up to plus seven, but plus three is great. And it's kind of tricky because I'm wondering, I haven't actually done the research, and I really love the research part of this business, is if you're on a Monday night, how many people who DVR us, and we had a huge increase,
huge DVR.
Oh, 33%.
Yep.
So, and then if you count last Sunday's viewership as well, I think it was over 20 million people.
Yeah.
So how do you, if you're on a Monday night, you might not watch until the weekend, Friday or Saturday or Sunday when you have time.
We won't
be counted in the plus three. So there's a little bit of a disadvantage, I would imagine. I don't know the research, but I'll have to ask Kelly Call question.
Kelly Call. He's a name we haven't brought up on the show in a while. That's it. They're a great company, CBS. They do pretty much everything right.
It's amazing because
Wrong with network television, but I don't think you'd know because you're at CBS.
No, Nina hired me. Nina hired me on ER.
Yeah.
And it was Nina and Les and David Staff and Kelly. And it's Nina and Les and David Staff and Kelly.
That is the only company I'd work for
and
out here, like
20,
if I went into business.
20 CBS. Years later.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah. That's why I think they're so successful because they're so stable. It is like a family.
And they're not And the thing about CBS that's interesting to me, and I'm sure you can see this from working with them now, is they aren't jumping the gun on all these crazy ideas and stuff like everyone else is doing, where they think, like, just because NBC sees a trend, and you were at NBC, so maybe you noticed this, they see a trend, they automatically have to restructure their scheduling and business plan and everything around that
right.
one trend.
I mean,
and it may not last, and it may not even be a real number.
It may not even be interesting.
Right, it may not even be interesting, right.
Well, when I was at NBC, which was for many, many years, and it was really phenomenal. There were four game-changing shows on at the same, you know, in the same years: Friends,
mm-hmm.
Seinfeld, Frasier, and
yeah,
ER.
Right. Yeah.
And so that's really what kept NBC going, because it was so experimental in a way. Just like CBS, you know, in the 70s had All in the Family, which really yeah. was a game changer. Or we can think of all the game changer shows like Desperate Housewives
yeah.
for ABC.
Sure.
American
Lost.
Idol, Lost, yeah. American Idol for Fox. So you need these game-changing, and then for CBS, CSI.
Yeah, right.
Huge game-changer for right. CBS. So you need these game-changers to keep things going. So what's really wonderful about being on in the summer is that we've been a game-changer so far, and that our show is the highest-rated summer drama in 21 years.
Yeah.
What does that mean? It means that people still want to see a broadcast. It's called broadcast because it's, you know,
because it's broad. Broad.
It's because it's a broad, broadly appealing,
uh-huh.
and people are still there. Knock on wood. I hope they stay, but people are still there for, you know, shows that can be compelling and engaging and exciting and tell good stories.
Now, I bet you didn't know this. Maybe you did know this though. I auditioned for Under the Dome.
You did?
Yes.
For
yes.
me? For me? Was
no.
I in the room?
No, for Sharon.
Ah.
And I go, Sharon goes, I need you to come in.
What part?
Wait a minute. Wait. I love the
well,
implication.
This is the best part.
I love the implication that's possible.
Were you like Barbie? Were you auditioning for Barbie?
This is good. So she calls me up.
Wait a minute.
What?
I love the implication of the fact he said, for me, he didn't know. Like, you could have auditioned and he would have forgotten
like,
you.
He could have. He yeah. could have. I've lost 40 some pounds since
I usually
too,
remember.
So that was probably
lost
a bigger
weight.
Deal. So Sharon calls me up and she goes, hey, listen, there's a script I'm doing. It's really, really good. We want to bring you in. And this is literally the day before the audition. She sent me the script. It was Phil. Correct.
We saw your tape.
Oh, see? So she literally sends me it the day of, right?
I remember.
And the day before. I go, I can't get ready for this in one day. Like, everyone's had this for like a week. She gave it to me one day. I come in, I do it. I thought the script was outstanding. And she goes, I just want you to know, we're not really auditioning white guys for this role. I go, oh, okay. Well, thank you, Sharon. I'm glad I could come in. She goes, but I want people to see you because I love you. So
true. I remember that now, because how did I know it was Phil?
No, that was
say,
good. You
I didn't
remember.
Say Big Jim. I didn't say, whoever.
He put radio host and podcast host together.
Right.
That's what Neil did.
No.
I
remember
that Harvard mind.
I remember
we'll get
that.
To the bottom of this.
Yeah, I had longer hair then, and I was fat.
I remember.
Real fat.
Well, I don't remember that part.
Oh, you do.
How sweet of
you
him.
You do, because
what
those were
nice
the network
guy.
Notes.
Yeah, right.
Fat. Les is putting together a fat guy skinny chick show for me right now.
Right.
Yeah. but I wanted to say that's how I read the script. I thought the script was phenomenal. And when I found out you were involved, and of course you had a book come out last year.
Right, Kill Switch.
Yeah, Kill Switch. And we've been trying to get you on forever. So I was just like, this is like the perfect thing for me. I'm a huge fan of yours.
Thank you.
I'm very, very grateful you've done this show. Are you going to work with John Wells again, you think?
I hope so. I mean, I'd
like
love to, but he's doing movies now.
I
and,
know, he is.
You know, no, I don't know
well,
him, you know.
He
you
is. Know. He's doing that Tracy Letts.
You know, with
Meryl Streep and Clooney's in it. And
Julia Roberts, Margot.
Yeah, everybody's in it. Everybody's in it. And you know how much we love Tracy Letts. We've talked about that numerous times.
Yeah.
One of the, you know, it's Tracy Letts has an interesting story, too. Not as interesting as Niels, but he was an actor who wasn't the greatest actor, and then he takes to writing, and he was.
And then he became a great Tony Award-winning actor.
And he's legitimately a great playwright.
And Bill Friedkin wanted to film his plays. You know.
Yeah, it was Killer Joe was what 91 or 92, right, and then Bug was 93 or 94,
Bug, right.
And Bug. Yeah, did you ever see that movie? Billy Friedkin and Tracy Letts.
Ashley Judd is great in it.
Isn't
Michael Shannon?
I gave Michael one of his first big TV shows.
Really?
I actually saw Michael on a plane about a month ago, and I introduced myself again. And I said, Michael, I'm Neil Barrett. I did SVU. Oh, God, that was so cool. That was. He said, that was a really creepy, creepy part. And I said, yeah, but you were not the perp.
Yeah.
And I told him I'd seen Bug and that... Who was it? Was it Frederick Forrest who was the really creepy guy? I think so. It was the hats. Do you remember the guy who had like a whole storage unit
of
kids' baseball caps? That was Michael Shannon. And he was totally
when Michael
fantastic.
Says it's creepy.
It's creepy.
Yeah. Right. Right. He's a little better in Bug than the movie Man of Steel. Did you see Man of Steel yet?
Not yet.
He's good in it, but
it's okay in it. It's
not
just
a
not,
good movie.
Doesn't hold me.
I don't put down a lot of movies on this show either, but I'm so disappointed in that one.
He's a great actor.
He
is terrific.
He's the best thing about The Iceman.
That's right here.
Which was
my
recently.
My son saw it and told me it was fantastic.
Yeah, he was very good in it. I love him. I think he's real. I've not yet to watch Boardwalk.
Uh-huh.
For all the stuff
he's
I watch.
He's got these reasons about
really?
Watching shows that don't take place
Come
in the
on.
Present. He's weird
well,
about
Well, I love Michael Pitt was on for a good
That's right.
of time.
Yeah.
He's such a brilliant actor. And
yeah.
And Kelly MacDonald is a fantastic actor. So.
Yeah, I love Michael Stuhlbarg.
Yep.
Yeah.
So when do you think you're going to know if Under the Dome's going to get a second summer?
I don't know.
How do these things usually work?
I think
for
they'll
you?
Look at the next week's ratings
I
and
think
see
so
how
too,
things
yeah.
go. And
yeah, that'd be exciting.
Would be
that'd
fantastic.
Be great. I think it's going to be a great show. I
well,
really
thanks.
Do.
Episode 7. I think, you know, I'm working with this guy named Walter Newman, who's won like 8 Emmys. He won like every year on ER. He does the sound mixing.
Oh, okay.
And so I said I have to have Walter for this show because I know how good Walter is on big shows. We did such big shows on ER. And so we were showing 7 to all of our post people and Snuffy who does our music, who did West Wing. It was fantastic. So Walter was crying during episode 7 and he said I would make John Wells proud because it is such a killer emotional show. And so I think, you know, as the episodes go, you start to really know the characters more and more, and we start to really get into the mythology of the dome.
Yeah.
And by the time we get to episode 7, it is just a killer. And we, like, no holds barred. I mean, you won't believe some of the things we do.
So this is just like if it was on basic cable.
Absolutely.
This could be on A&E, AMC, all those networks, and you wouldn't notice the difference.
Yeah. Yeah.
See, that's why this show's so interesting for me, too, is it's an adult show. On network TV again. And those are hard to come by nowadays, where it's not watered down.
No one is safe under the dome.
Yeah, that's great.
No
yeah.
one.
That's great.
Tagline.
You know, how come, did you have an offer to do West Wing at any point in time, or it was Law and
no,
Order
first?
No,
because I was doing ER when West Wing started, but
ER,
I actually
so.
Worked once with Aaron when Martin Sheen's character was shot. I went over and sat with Aaron and talked about sort of the medical aspects of all of that.
Oh,
that's interesting.
Had a
I love how
tiny,
you're like
tiny.
The medical go-to guy.
Yeah.
For TV. Yeah.
For TV.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Anyone in film call you up for medical? They don't care in film.
No,
though.
But, you know,
like,
I get a lot of questions from the actors and the crew about their kids.
If I ever really,
really
get shot, I'm going to call Neil.
Right.
He won't tell me what to do, but he'll tell me how I can write about it.
That's right.
What do you like more? Do you like writing a show more or writing more?
I like both. What I like about TV is it's so collaborative, and yet it can drive you crazy, you know, where if you're really, you know, focused on all the details as I am, then you can't control because it is collaborative.
Yeah,
I cannot
right.
do the wardrobe. I cannot paint the walls. Like, you know,
it's
collaborative. Whereas when you're writing a novel, when I did Kill Switch,
right.
you are the wardrobe, hair, makeup, DP. You do everything, write the dialogue. And so all problems, mistakes, go to you, whereas in TV it still goes to you if you're the showrunner, but you're yelling, and I don't yell, but you're like freaking out over all kinds of things that you kind of don't have control over.
Well, the collaborative aspect of TV is kind of a blessing, but it also drives you nuts at the same time.
It's fun though because
you know?
It's fast, so it's like What show are we on? I think we're shooting episode 11, and we're prepping episode 12, and we're writing episode 13, and we're cutting episode 8 and 9, and it's just...
You rarely hear from a show that's going well, too, where the collaborative process isn't good. There's a moonlighting here and there where there's fighting and whatever. But, for instance, Gary David Goldberg, unfortunately, passed a few weeks ago, yes. And Michael Whitehorn posted on Facebook. And Michael posted on Facebook the little table they sat at for Family Ties that they wrote at, and like six, seven writers. And this table was literally the size of what we're sitting at now. And it was seven guys sitting around writing. And they looked like the happiest motherfuckers on the planet.
I'm sure. No, it's really fun. Really there's something did. About being in the room. We don't sit at a table under the dome.
This is
we
like
sit
cafeteria
in,
shit they were sitting
at. We sit in easy chairs, like in a circle. Yeah. So I've never done that because in ER, we were at a big table.
Sure.
SVU was not a room show. Everybody wrote their own episodes.
Right.
And then I would come in and they'd pitch to me and we'd talk about their outlines on the board. And then I'd do things on the scripts. But... This is just.
Do you like a room show better than?
It's really great because I hadn't done it for so long, and so this is so much a room show because we have to keep so many. It's like today when we were working on the finale, and it's like, oh my god, like okay, Linda's here and Julia's there, and the kids are here, and where's the dome, and where's the? I almost gave away something. So so it's like whoa, you know. Keeping it all in line, you need a lot of really great brains in there.
When writers get together and they write this way, where it's a collaborative effort, but someone gets a writing credit, when it's one person that gets a writing credit. First of all, how does that work for our listeners where, okay, we have a team unit, but one person got the credit? And if people are throwing in their own ideas, are they ever aggravated that they gave a really good idea to someone else who's getting a credit?
Well, it's very different from comedy, of course, where that's written kind of in the room.
It's a battlefield.
So for us, we were finding our way, like what worked. And so what we found that worked for us is that we have two big boards and we would write out, kind of sketch out the whole episode and then really like outline it in, you know, like three sentences per beat on this board. And there are like usually five or six beats per act and there's a teaser and four acts. So, so that would be five times... about 30 scenes, and sometimes between 30 and 50 scenes, depending on the episode. So we would break it down and talk about each beat and write somebody with good handwriting, like Caitlin Parrish, one of our writers, would write it all up there. And then the writer who gets the credit would write up the outline, and then we'd get notes, and I would do notes, and Brian K. Vaughan would do notes with me. And then they'd write the script, and the network and the studio would give notes, but I would give notes first and throughout. So,
and you do this all in 1 week. Is this like 1 week in the writer's room? It used to be. Is it not anymore?
Not for a drama. It's usually about, I would say, 5 days to break a story.
Okay.
And then maybe about a week to write it.
So even ER, they'd give you like 2 weeks to write it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
So with comedy, really, then, sitcoms, because I know
that's
Ken Levine and David Isaacs, it was always you'd have to have it written and done from Monday to like Friday.
But then they would always get, like, that third week off?
Right, that's true.
Like, wow.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. But, yeah, so that's fascinating for me, how collaborative it is. And then, you still deal with network notes and everything. So how do you decide who gets the credit? How's that based?
The writer who writes the outline and the script.
Okay.
And even so, so it's an amalgamation of everybody's ideas in every episode.
Right.
But that writer has translated and transformed them into the outline and the script. And everybody gets a chance.
Right.
Everybody
so
gets
as a showrunner, you make sure everybody writes.
And I never credit jump. So even if I had to rewrite a whole episode, as has happened, there are some showrunners who do jump credits, and you'll see names on every script and things like that. So, you know, that's the John Wells thing, is that John, you had mentioned John is a brilliant producer. He starts you out from the very beginning. As a staff writer, you go to casting, you go to editing, you go on the set. You're really like running your own show, and you learn those skills, which are not really taught anymore. And so we try to do that on our show and as well as on SVU. And so your job as a showrunner, at least John felt this way and I do too, is that you're paid to do the rewrites and punching things up and all of that. And so that's part of your job.
Are you very hands-on as a showrunner? Do you trust people like do their jobs?
I've become less hands-on in a way because there's just so much in life one can control,
so much
as I'm learning.
Yeah.
And so I'm very hands-on in editing.
Yes.
Very hands-on in editing because I've edited for so long, 20 years. So, you know, I've learned a lot and had a lot of experience and opportunity. And I'm pretty hands-on in the script stage. But I'm not in North Carolina telling people, you know, how to, you know, set decorate and stuff.
No,
you know, if there's something,
you even made it sound like with Law and Order that you were out here. Half
yeah,
the
I was
time
absolutely.
And,
so yeah. You just hire the best people you can and the best line producers you can, which I always have, the best directors, and then you don't have to worry about it. And you have tone meetings. So how does our vision get through? Well, we have three times it can happen. First, the concept meeting. So we just did episode 12 today. So the concept meeting is to go through the script and talk about all of the issues that are production issues. And it's our time as the writer-producers to do that. So we'd say, well, episode 12 has these special effects or this kind of we need a stunt coordinator for a scene between Mike and Alex that, you know, something happens, et cetera. So we go through all of the special things we might need, props,
yeah,
things like that. And then we do a production meeting, and that's run by the AD in North Carolina, but we're on – the writer-producer's on for that show to hear, bring up any issues. And then the tone meeting I run, and I work with the director, and I go through every scene, and I talk about what the subtext is, where the actors have been in previous episodes, because the directors haven't, you know, necessarily seen everything. We give them all the episodes previously to watch. And so it gives us continuity, and we answer questions. We might do some polishes even then. We're always polishing till we shoot, and then we're still polishing.
See, this is the
I
difference
love the idea
between,
of a tone meeting.
Well, you know, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. This is the difference between the average guys in the business that do average to sometimes good or great work because they got a great team or whatever, and really good guys in the business. I mean, I've never heard a show broken down like that. Have you?
We should have tone meetings for this show.
Have you heard that?
No, I haven't.
Before, where it's that broken down?
That's really paying attention to...
So most of the people we have on are comedy guys.
Yeah,
so maybe that's part of it.
Yeah, but like paying attention
they
to
do
not...
atonement.
Yeah,
not
right.
Not only the technical aspects of what you're making, but what... And this is something that I don't think a lot of people in TV and even movies ask is, why are we doing this?
Right.
Why are we...
Right. Actors want to know.
Why
so.
Are, but like not just like the actor's motivation. Why are we putting the camera here?
Right.
Why are we choosing not to say this or to say
right.
this?
We
why
talk did, about yeah. we talk you about know, the visual style.
Yeah.
You know, I'll say, for instance, I'll say, we don't pan off buildings, flagpoles, trees. Nothing drives me crazier
right.
than to watch a drama where... The scene starts on a tree and pans on to people talking. It's like,
or where it
no,
ends with a pan
no.
up to the skyline.
No. We don't do that.
Yeah.
One of my producers, Pat Tobias, asked. He wanted to know why, how the decision came about from CBS to bypass the pilot and go straight to 13 episodes.
There wasn't time to get it on in the summer, so it was like it was really interesting because when you have a pilot, you're able to tweak and. Usually pilots are shot on location, then you build your sets and, you know, you can reassess and sometimes recast. So for us, it's like shoot the pilot in 15 days, actually 12 days plus three for the special effects. And the next day is episode two. It's like, whoa, you know, we better be happy with everything. Or we're reevaluating while we're getting the dailies. So there's a lot of pressure. That was hard.
Yeah.
But the flip side and the really positive side is there's no pilot.
Right.
You don't have to wait.
Right.
So see if you're
picked
up.
Do you know why they gave
always
you a 13
time to get
episode
it on
order
summer.
Right out of it? Right
because
out of the
they
game?
Wanted to do this summer
presentation.
It was presentation.
Because of the timeline.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And we
okay.
could never get the shows on. Like right now, as I said, we're already on the air and we've aired two shows and we're still shooting three more shows. So in order for us to be on schedule, we had to start shooting at the end of February.
Wow.
With no breaks.
And then final, I got one last question, but then final one is, as a great writer, how do you feel about development executives and others proposing drastic changes to scripts? I would doubt you have that under the dome.
No.
Have you had that before where people have...
No, I'm really lucky. Julie McNamara is the head of development at CBS and like,
yeah.
one of the smartest people
when
I know.
You tend to work
that doesn't
hit,
help us.
Well, when you tend to work on hit shows, they tend to stay out of your way.
No, but no. They're equal opportunity note givers.
Oh, okay.
But
okay.
But Julie is really smart, and
okay.
she's and a delightful person. And so, you know, I listen because it's not just kind of crazy bullshit. Like,
yeah.
You know,
okay.
Change it from blue to green or
that's
something.
That's what we wanted to know. Yeah. Like, fine, smart people giving smart,
but
relevant
advice.
But does
the leather jacket stay or go?
Right.
My last question for you is film ever in your future? Can you see yourself directing like John Wells is doing writing a film?
I just started out as a directing fellow at AFI,
right.
And I directed an after-school special with Mike Warren from Hill Street Blues and and Cary Green from Goonies and Lucas, and it was really quite fun, but I just am too busy as a writer-producer because it takes you about a month to do the prep and do the directing and do the editing, and so I've never done that. And to direct movies, I don't know, the movie business, I have a couple of movie development. I wrote a movie for Keanu Reeves years ago that never went. I wrote a movie for Mace Neufeld based on an Oliver Sacks story from The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat that John Lithgow was attached to that never went.
Wow.
Based on
some of Keanu's work lately, maybe they should have gone with yours. Maybe they
he would have played a doctor, you know, a surgeon.
Well,
okay.
Maybe he should have gone.
He played a doctor.
He played a doctor. Something's got to give.
That's right.
With Diane Keaton.
That's right.
Yeah. And Thumbsucker. Yeah. Or he was a dentist.
And Thumbsucker, yeah. Dentist. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So he's done both.
Yes.
MDs and
both sides of the medical realm coin.
How do you feel about dentists calling themselves DDSs? They don't deserve it, right?
Oh, sure. It's a hard job. It's a hard job.
All right. Neil Baird, thank you so much for doing the show. Under the Dome, of course, is on Monday night. 10/9 Central, and if you DVR it, watch it within 3 days.
Thank you, by the way, for doing an extensive and heavily jam-packed interview.
It's great information.
Oh, sure. My pleasure.
Yes. Well, I've been working 2 years getting him on, so I had a lot of questions.
Right.
I had a list.
thank you so much, Neil.
We're going to take a break.
We'll be right back after we kidnap John Wells.
Yeah, right. That's our next plan. And then when we come back, you're going to hear the interview I did with Matthew Cook. And the film is How to Make Money Selling Drugs. Neil Baird, thank you. And check out Under the Dome, 10/9 Central, Monday nights. It's going to be episode 3 Monday. You can catch up with the former episodes on iTunes and Amazon, and then 3 through 13 weekly. Just Amazon? No, it's not. No iTunes.
Not iTunes.
We don't like iTunes.
Catch up with us on iTunes.
CBS.com, Xfinity.com, all those places.
Yeah.
I know that's where I watched the first one was Xfinity. So,
what music are you going to play?
I think I'm going to play some Dumb and Dumber soundtrack.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
For the people and ones, woman them a flex and the man them a chance. Cause the 60s style it have to come back. Draw for your bell bottom, black heel and frocks. Boom shakala, crude boy. You only tell them no. Wild.
Lee, are you back?
Great interview.
There you go. Did you enjoyed that one?
Yeah.
I got to tell you, he may be the smartest guy we've ever had on the show. On top of it, he had to have given the most technical information we've ever had on this show.
I know, but it was like extensive, and it never
it
felt
great.
Like he was lecturing us
no.
either.
No.
Because I don't know. First of all, I didn't know about half that stuff, because I didn't grow up watching a lot of shows like ER.
Sure.
You know me.
Yeah, right.
I watch movies, but... Yeah, he makes it really understandable.
But that's how I got so into ER, because I didn't watch a lot of shows like that when I was growing up.
Uh-huh.
That's how I got into shows like that, is I recognized the cinematic aspect of a show like ER. They're an hour and 7 hour and a half, but I mean, it was like watching a movie every week for me.
Right.
Because it was serialized. It wasn't procedural of the week, you know. It wasn't sure, they had different cases all the time, but the characters were serialized. Things happened that were serialized, and it was the first show for me that really got me into that, drama-wise. Comedy, uh-huh. Of course, everyone knows I've seen every sitcom, but yeah. Drama-wise, yeah. ER was the first show for me that I was really, really into.
Uh-huh.
I just dug the drama. Now, I got to say, the best thing about having Neil on, though, was that story of his, how he broke in the business, is maybe the best one we've had on the show.
Yeah,
It's insane.
It's a really good story.
You could tell he has some energy, though.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like he was almost holding in some energy. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
Like he's high energy.
He's high strung. I was curious to know how much coffee he drank.
And creatine.
So
jacked.
You're thinking of you.
Yeah, right.
But that's a guy who I feel like he was even just like holding back telling us how much, because that was like the guy drinks a lot. The guy's wired.
Right. Right, right.
And he's wired from life.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I love his reaction, though, to your question where you go, you still drink a lot of coffee? He's like, I still drink a lot of coffee. Yeah, yeah. Coffee.
Yeah.
Yeah, I still drink. And he made it sound like, oh, yeah, not that much, like I used to drink.
Yeah.
I don't know what Neil used to drink.
I only drink 15 cups a day.
Right. I was going to say, that guy's got a Starbucks gold card.
Yeah, right.
VIP. Next week's guest is going to be Adam Green,
mm-hmm.
Of course, from the director and writer of the film Frozen and Hatchet.
Yes.
And Hatchet 2. Hatchet 3 is coming out. And Holliston, his television show as well, which is a comedy. Adam's fascinating for me, and this is why I'm encouraging you guys all to tune in next week for the Sam Green interview. This guy does his own stuff. He's a big horror movie guy. He's huge in the horror community. he has been offered some big stuff that he won't do because he wants to do his own things. And he's a really respectable guy.
My favorite kind of person.
Not only that, he is one of the smartest film fans you're ever going to talk to. He's very much like when we had Eli Roth on and people like that. People that just know their film and not just horror movies. They know their cinema.
Another interview I was not there for.
So I'm really looking forward to Adam Green. You will be here for that one.
Okay.
And Stevie Ryan from Stevie TV, which is on VH1. She's a comedian. She has her own show on VH1. It's a sketch comedy show. Stevie will be here next week. She's funny, and she is drop-dead gorgeous, which none of you will get to see.
Yeah,
unless,
but we will.
Unless you go to our Facebook page, you type in the Matthew Aaron Show, you click like, and you will see pictures
will
from
see,
that show.
And we are all also on iTunes and
right.
Stitcher.
No.
I
but on the Facebook, though, they can see the pictures of Stevie Ryan coming on.
Yeah.
And we'll make sure to take plenty of cleavage shots.
Yeah, cleavage shots. And you can, you click like, and then you'll be able to see the pictures of Stevie in my lap.
Right.
Bitch.
So,
sorry.
Neil Bear, is there anything else that you have from that you wanted to take
from
that?
That was great. That was great.
I wanted to say happy birthday to a friend of mine, Nadia Lanfranconi, and Kurtwood Smith. Turned 70 today, and I said happy birthday 70? To Kurtwood earlier. Yes.
Kurtwood.
So make sure you say happy birthday to Kurtwood on the Facebook when you get a chance. Kurtwood, a great guest on this show we had.
Yeah.
Maybe one of the classiest gentlemen we've ever met.
He's great.
And our next guest is Matthew Cook. He's the director of How to Make Money Selling Drugs, and him and Adrian Grenier, as Caesar keeps... what is it? Grenier. Grenier. Do you really care how to pronounce Adrian Grenier's name?
No.
Is it Grenier? Did I get it right?
No.
Grenier?
Grenier.
Grenier. No, but Matthew Cook and Adrian Grenier.
Grenier.
Of course, from Entourage, everyone knows. I can screw up his name. He's still about $20 million richer than me, so who cares? Matthew and him, of course, are producing partners. They've done some documentaries together. This one is a winner, a big winner. It's How to Make Money Selling Drugs.
It's a very entertaining. It's as entertaining as it is informative.
And that
as
is
movie.
Sometimes...
It's very good.
As sometimes as... I like documentaries like that.
Me
I don't
too.
Need to be bored to death.
All right, well, you're...
Yeah, you're all about being bored.
Yes.
You're a boring guy. Yeah. I'm fun.
How is it...
that just shows the personality.
What
clashes.
Does it feel like to not be able to focus on something longer than 4 minutes? Is that tough?
No,
that's got to be real
I
rough.
I can focus on things for longer than 4 minutes. I just can't focus on boredom for longer than four
okay,
minutes.
Okay, yeah.
Why don't you tell our listeners terrible. The movies you rented yesterday?
Well,
put them to sleep.
Okay.
Put them to sleep.
I rented for my new region-free DVD player, which now allows me to play movies from any region, part of the country. I have House of Lava by the great Pedro Costa. I have Cloud-Capped Star by Ritwik Gitwack. And the terrific, terrific likes of Ken Loach, which is his early movie Poor Cow, which features Terrence Stamp, who you're a fan of.
I am a fan of Terrence.
Yes, terrific. And the clip from Poor Cow can be seen in the Limey during the flashbacks. When they flashback to young Terrence Stamp's character in Soderbergh's The Limey, it's a flashback to Poor Cow. Wonderful, wonderful cinema that's now available to me with the amenities provided by my region-free DVD player.
Listeners, are you still there?
Yes.
Please. I hope you're still there to hear this Matthew Cook interview. Here it is, How to Make Money Selling Drugs, which is in theaters now, in select theaters now, and also you can catch it on demand. Lee,
thank you
today's show.
Oh,
you did great. Let's have some dinner.
Thanks, boss.
I got my chap Salid waiting for me. Here's Matthew Cook, How to Make Money Selling Drugs.
Thank you.
Okay, welcome to the Matthew Aaron Show, and this is Matthew Aaron. I'm here with Matthew Cook, who is calling in about his film, How to Make Money Selling Drugs. It's a new documentary that is produced by Adrian Greiner and directed by Matthew. It's on demand, and you can download it on iTunes, Amazon, and Google Play. It's going to be in select theaters on June 28th. Matthew, how are you doing?
Matthew, I am great. It's nice to be here.
That's good. I'm glad you're doing good. So explain to me the process of putting this film together, because you've made a few films now, and documentaries aren't something that you're obviously adverse to. So why this film?
I don't hate documentaries. I don't hate information that the public needs to find out about in order to make all of our lives better. I'm not against that. How to make money selling drugs is a different take on that process. So what better way to give people information to make their lives a little better than with the comedy pill and with a thrill ride with the kind of stories that we have in this movie?
Well, let me ask you, before we get into the film, I do want to talk about you a little bit. You, I know you spent a good portion of your years in Chicago. Is that true?
That is true.
So I'm a Chicago guy. You're kind of a Chicago guy. What was your Chicago background?
I moved to Chicago for high school. When I was 14 years old, I went to Evanston Township High School, which is, you know, for those people who don't know, the first suburb to the north. It has a great theater department. ETHS has some fantastic names that have come through there. Ajay Naidu, great, great actor. Of course, John Cusack and Jeremy Piven, to name just a few. And
I'm well with that. I love those guys. It's in Evanston. Evanston was crowded with those kind of guys. And then, of course, Piven Theater, which was Jeremy's mom and dad. And that brought up a lot of great actors, too. But, yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually went to the Piven Theater Company for a class or two. And I was in Chicago from the age 14 to a year after high school, where I was playing in bands, and that was a time I thought I was going to be playing music for the rest of my life, and then made a move to go toward filmmaking instead. And those 5 years in Chicago were very, very formative. That was the time that I was making fake IDs, which was my foray into the black market world. And I didn't have friends at the time who were in the drug game, but had I could see that I possibly might have gotten into that just to make ends meet and put food on the table and be able to have a little extra cash.
Well, I was going to ask you how much your formative years in high school had to do with the documentary itself, because when, you know, you were talking about you were making fake IDs between the ages of 14 to like 24, I was selling drugs. So, I mean, it was like one of those things where, you know, that's sometimes what you do as a kid. And so
absolutely.
I was very curious how much that had to do with your upbringing.
Yeah, you know, some of it did. I mean, we didn't have a whole hell of a lot of money when I was 14 to 18. And there were a couple of times where we didn't have a place that we were living kind of officially. We were staying with friends. My family was staying with friends. And I couch surfed a great friend of mine, Molly Buren let me crash on her couch in the basement for a semester of high school. And that was great. And, but I needed some cash, and a lot of kids want to drink beer and they need IDs to do it. And so I was the man to make them for them.
So this is what's funny to me. You made IDs for kids. I just sold booze to kids. So we were both awful human beings. So that's good to know.
Terrible Matthew.
We were terrible human beings.
Too bad, Matthew.
We were gift from God my ass. Yes.
Yes, exactly.
So let me ask you then, you go to college, you kind of clean up your lifestyle with the fake ID business, and there comes a point in time, you graduate from school, you did the same thing I did, you went to school for some BS like film, and and then what's the next step after that, after you graduate, you get your film degree, which gets you everywhere in the world, and then what do you do?
People really respect a film degree.
Yeah, right.
They really just think you're obviously a wise man who makes good decisions in life. What did I do? I went and got a production assistant job, and I worked as a PA, you know, picking up people's cigarette butts in front of a bad sci-fi movie that was being made. And I did that for a while, and then the producer I was working for literally actually grabbed me by the shirt and put me up against the wall and said, Matthew, what are you doing with your life? You keep on this track, you're just going to turn into an a-hole like me. And I said, yeah, I realized that you're probably right. And said, you know, if you want to write and direct, films, you got to just go do it. Go start writing films, go start shooting stuff. And I didn't know really where to begin. I couldn't even afford a video camera at the time. And, you know, there weren't iPhones then, so I couldn't just start shooting something. So I endeavored into the process of writing screenplays, which took me about 7 years. I wrote a ton of really, really bad, unreadable screenplays.
Yeah.
And while I was doing that and learning the craft, slowly and painstakingly, I needed a job. And so my job was graphic design. And it just so happened that that was the dot-com era. And so my graphic design job, which was like a web design company in my garage, basically me and two friends doing web design for Capitol Records and other various clients who needed multimedia work, that little garage-based enterprise turned into a $7 million dot-com, which was the most distracting thing that I could have possibly done to take me away from my passion, which was filmmaking. And so for a couple years, I did that. But at the end of the day, what it gave me was a real background in visual arts. And so when it came time to do how to make money selling drugs, it was a very exciting moment because I felt like the chains had been kind of, you know, taken off, so to speak. And I was able to put all of that background into making something for an artistic purpose that I could really get behind.
Let me ask you something, because I have a friend that was a lot like you. He makes six figures right now, and he wants to leave that job to be an animator. So he's a fucking idiot. And you made six,
right,
seven figures, and you left your job to be a filmmaker, you momo. Why'd
yeah.
you do it? Why'd
yeah.
you do it? Why?
It's the quality of life, man. The quality of life is so much more valuable than any money. I was working 70 hours a week, and yeah, I made a lot of money, but I wasn't doing anything that really made me happy. And making movies makes me happy. I love spending time with all these crazy people that I get to interview and going on these crazy joy rides. And I mean, you know, spending the year... 2 years we made Teenage Paparazzo. Those were some of the best years of my life. Same thing with How to Make Money Selling Drugs, you know, getting to sit in the back of a DEA van chasing 200 kilos of cocaine. I mean, you can't, you know, pay to have those kind of life experiences. So
no,
I wouldn't trade it for the world. My advice to your friend is go for it.
Go for it. Okay, so let me ask you about Teenage Paparazzo then. This is the first film that you end up doing with Adrian, and Adrian directed that one, correct?
That's right.
Okay, so how did you get involved with your relationship with Adrian Greiner? What's your relationship? How did that start?
We met, I don't know, like a decade ago through mutual friends, and we had a big, there was a big party that I threw at my house, and he and his band, the Honey Brothers, I think they came over for the party, and I think they were still there 2 or 3 days later. And we just became fast friends and shared a lot of mutual interests. And he saw on my idea board, which is this big bulletin board that I've always had in my house, wherever it is, which is covered with different ideas and graphic designs and treatments and whatever the hell to represent various ideas at various stages. And he pointed at one, which was this big yellow Cliff Notes guidebook that said how to make money selling drugs. And he started laughing and he said, "What the hell is that?" I said, "That's a movie I want to make." And he said, "That's a movie I want to make." And so 10 or so years later, after I'd done Deliver Us from Evil, he wanted to know if I would help him with Teenage Paparazzo. And I said, absolutely. It sounds like a blast. And right after that, he said, it's time to make money selling drugs. So we did it.
I love it. That's like a true friendship then. What makes that like a non-Hollywood bullshit friendship?
You know what it is? It's totally honest. We will tell each other if we don't like an idea, we will just slam it. We'll destroy it for each other. And we always know that at the end of the day, this is just it's just art, it's just communication, it's just choosing how we want to express ourselves. And we keep it separate from the friendship. You know, there's never a creative disagreement that would ever, you know, affect our ability to laugh at it. And I think at the end of the day, you know, we'd stay light on our feet and we're both interested in the same thing, which is to make stuff that's really entertaining, that's really fun, that that changes hearts and minds and is being made for the right reasons.
That's great. So how to make money selling drugs. This is your first directorial feature, right? I know you've directed some sketches and stuff before for Fuel TV, was it?
Yeah, I did a comedy, bunch of comedy sketches for Fuel. And the kind of producer I am, I'm a creative producer. I'm not a numbers guy, and I'm not a schedule guy. I don't raise financing, so that's really not what I do. As a producer, in the past, my job has been to shadow the director and really try to creatively pull the best performance out of them and help facilitate and be a sounding board for all of those ideas. So my experience as a creative producer was really, really helpful in preparing me for how to make money selling drugs, directing it. And then also as a creative director in advertising, which I did for many, many years, there was a similar role in that regard. So even though it's my feature directorial debut, it doesn't feel like it. It feels like work that I've been doing all along.
Well, you were so prepared for this that it can't feel like it. You were well prepared to direct this film.
I think so, and doing the amount of work I've done from a visual standpoint, I was just so excited to make advertising quality graphics for the purpose of an entertaining thrill ride about the drug war, and that would take audiences in a direction that hopefully they've never seen before in a documentary film. So, I mean, I couldn't have been more excited to make the movie when it became available to finally do so.
Someone with the visual creative acumen that you have, I mean, this is kind of what blows my mind about your talent, is you could have a huge range. Do you see yourself doing big budget features? Because that's something that I think with your vision you could probably do.
Thank you. Yes, I appreciate that. And I do, I am actually developing I haven't announced it yet, and so I don't want to say with who, but I'm working with an awesome producer developing a big sci-fi thriller.
Man,
that I've had
in
the back burner for years. What's that?
Sci-fi's all the rage, brother. Are we ever going to make a romantic comedy ever again, or is it sci-fi every movie? Every movie's going to be sci-fi.
No. We now live in a science fiction world. It's no longer – it's science fact. I mean, we live in such a bizarre – it's such a bizarre time, you know, with the internet and,
yeah,
airplanes and cars and everything. I mean, you know, I sound like a jackass saying that, but like, you know, for hundreds of thousands of years, the world looked nothing like it did for the last hundred.
Well,
so I feel like I'm constantly tripping out on how sci-fi of an existence we actually live.
I hear you. So just without spoiling what this big project is you're working on, what makes your sci-fi project different than every sci-fi movie coming out every week, like Superman, Pacific Rim? I mean, I could run through weekly, and it's like a new sci-fi film.
Yes, the concept is not – it's not a one-trick pony. I try to make films that every 10 to 15 minutes or so, the bottom drops out. I mean, that's what Andy Berg and I tried to do with Deliver Us From Evil, is really structured in such a way where by the time you get to the end, you really have gone, you know, deeply into the rabbit hole as far as you can to discover what needs to be discovered to really have the emotional catharsis that's necessary to change your heart and mind about a particular subject. And I did the same thing. Hopefully the audience will feel the same way about How to Make Money Selling Drugs, even though it's a completely different type of film.
Sure.
And my intention is to do the same thing with my fiction films as well, which is to make it so that they're not one-trick ponies, where it's not just one concept and then that thing lasts throughout the film.
Well, and, you know, you said something that was very interesting. You said you want to keep going down as far in the rabbit hole as you can. David O. Russell says that with every film, like, he doesn't think it's a good film unless every 15 minutes you're getting, like, punched in the gut somehow. And
I could not agree more. That's a great rule.
Yeah, I think that is a great rule. So How to Make Money Selling Drugs. This is a really interesting film because I think – there's still a stigma, I think, for people that aren't overly intelligent, that documentaries tend to be boring. How, now we've already talked about your visual and your creative acumen here and how you can structure something to be exciting. But you made this documentary, so it's literally in a weird way like a step-by-step process of how to make money selling drugs or how to get to certain levels. How did you go about, like, you're like, okay, we need to make this exciting for the audience. We have a great topic. We have great facts. We have great subjects. How do we make this exciting? How was that process?
Well, it started with that. So it wasn't like, okay, here are a whole bunch of great subjects. How do we structure it? It would have been so much easier to make a traditional documentary out of that material. But what I'd set out to do was to make this guidebook. So the original concept was a Cliff Notes guide. So it was literally this, like, a teacher's aid tool, which I just thought was so funny, because obviously what Cliff Notes guide, what school in their right mind is going to teach you how to do this incredibly irreverent, illegal thing? And then along the way, it just occurred to me that, in a movie, it's going to be much more entertaining to not do a takeoff on a book. Cliff Notes guide is a book, obviously. So what's the video version of the Cliff Notes guide? And as a former avid, obsessive video game player, I love going to YouTube and going to seeking out the walkthrough guide.
Right, or the frequently asked questions. Yeah, right. The FAQs for Link to the Past or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. So if I'm playing Assassin's Creed or whatever, you know, ridiculous game that I'm super into, and I know I am not going to stop playing this video game for the next, 37 hours until I win. my only way out is if I hit YouTube and find that walkthrough guide. And that was my inspiration for doing, like, the video game walkthroughs. I thought, oh, that's funny.
That's fascinating. Because I'll tell you something else that I love the video game connection. See, this is where your mind is unique for this business. And this is where you can relate to younger people. And it's just great. I don't think 99% of the people out here would have thought about going about that route, and it's really smart. What is your personal opinion on the laws for drugs in America? For instance, I'm pretty sure we can guess what your feelings are on marijuana restrictions in America, but let's talk about heavy drugs. What is your opinion on those?
I think that it's absolutely insane to try to legislate people's morality when it comes to what they are doing with their own bodies and minds. And the reality with the harder drugs is that these people who are doing the harder drugs, who are doing heroin, who are doing cocaine, they're going to do those drugs whether they're illegal or not. So do we want to take those people and hit them over the head with the hammer of the criminal justice system and put them in prison, where they're going to lose their right to vote, where they're going to lose their ability to get a good job when they come out, and where they're likely going to continue to be able to use drugs while they're in prison and buy them from the various black market resources that are available behind bars anyway? Or do we want to treat them with empathy and compassion, because what addiction really is a medical problem, not a law enforcement problem? So that would be my response.
Okay, there's a lot of me that agrees with you about that. I guess my only fear is with when it comes to drugs or when it comes to anything else is I don't think we are to judge people's morality. No, I agree with you on that. I don't think we're the morality gauge. But then what makes things right or wrong if things are illegal and not illegal? Know what I'm saying?
I don't think that we need to outlaw gonorrhea or have a law against syphilis or herpes in order to encourage people to not contract those sexually transmitted diseases.
You're right. People are going to keep doing it, whether it's illegal or not. That's true.
Absolutely. And if someone has a lot of pain in their heart or in their mind, and they're seeking solace in the abuse of drugs, why are we putting them in jail? Why are we punishing them for having this psychological affliction that they already have? Let's help them. If we really care, let's help them. And the reality is that the origin of most of these drug laws are, they're racist in their in their inception. You know, the marijuana laws were originally created particularly to target Mexicans. I mean, literally, the politicians at the turn of the century were saying that Mexicans smoking marijuana gained superhuman strength. They said that, you know, and that's what they read. I mean, it's so absurd, and it's funny, but it's also horrifying because, you know, these guys were really putting Mexicans in prison. And why were they doing that? Because of racism, because they wanted to protect jobs for the white majority. And the same thing happened with cocaine. You know, cocaine was a drug that people used. You know, Freud used it. Obviously, that's a famous one. The guy who created who built the Statue of Liberty, he is quoted as saying if he'd been able to get his hands on more of that cocaine wine that he got into later in his life, he would have made the Statue of Liberty 100 feet taller.
I
love cocaine.
Let's be honest. A little bit of cocaine never hurt anybody, okay? So
a little bit of cocaine didn't. Right.
You're right. It never hurt anybody. Have a good time here and there.
Yeah, that's going to be the quote that's going to be pulled from this out when we're both going to be lambasted for the rest of our lives.
Well, yeah, no, you pull this quote, put it on your posters. You're good. A little bit of cocaine never hurt. Brother, I got to tell you, I'm really excited to have interviewed you. I wish we could have done it in person. I know you're a busy man, but this is a great honor. You're a cool dude. How to Make Money Selling Drugs, of course, is on demand on Amazon, on Google Play, on iTunes, and it's going to be in select cities come June 26th. Which cities are you going to be in? Do you know? New York, I'm guessing?
I know I'll be in L.A. on the 28th, which is a week away, and I know we'll be in New York. Yeah, New York and L.A. next week, and I'll try to get around to as many theaters as they can.
Oh, I'm going to an L.A. screening.
It's available now on hand and on iTunes.
Yeah, I'm going to an L.A. screening.
But I'm going to try to go to Chicago.
Well,
sure.
I wish I could see it in Chicago. I'm in L.A. right now, but I'm going to go to an L.A. screening. I'm going to let our fans know about it, and because I want to see this on the big screen. But, yes, it is on demand, and then you can catch it on Amazon and iTunes. And it's well worth your time. It's a great documentary, especially if you give a shit about the war on drugs. I think I know that's not like the big message of the film. Well, it is and it isn't. There is that message in the film. So, I mean, there are some political messages that you would care about, and it's educational, and it's an eye-opener. So, I mean, you should be really proud. Good for you.
And thank you, Matthew.
Did you want to ask? My producer, Caesar, really liked the film, and I know he had a question for you, if you don't mind.
No, not at all. Go ahead.
Go ahead,
Caesar. Hey, Matthew. Great job on the film, by the way. I really enjoyed it. Just kind of wondering how you came up with the narrative, the way it evolved from like the beginning where it was stage by stage, and it kind of turned into a story about laws and things like that.
It was always the intention to tell the full story. And when you make a movie, when you tell a story, the idea is that you want to start one way and you want to end a different way. And you want to have an arc that's emotional where as often as it feels right, you're raising the stakes emotionally. And that's what creates the thrill ride in our hearts that we feel when we go and see movies. You know, what are the turns that take place every 10 or 15 minutes, like Matthew was mentioning about David O. Russell's formula. You know, so when conceiving of the narrative arc, I always knew that I wanted to end the film on this serious note and wanted to start it like Goodfellas. You know, ever since I was a kid, I wanted to be a gangster. And that's the feeling that I felt as a kid doing my black market illicit activities. And that was the testimony that I had heard from all the interviewees and subjects that I found in describing their experience in the drug game. So I just tried to structure it in a way that would bring the audience on that same journey and as quick of a pace as possible so we could go as far and deep as we could in the story in 90 minutes. And so the process of editing for a couple of years was just balancing, you know, how much of this story do we tell, how much of that story do we tell, and finding the balance for the tone so that it could be satirical and fun and entertaining and feel like a movie and that people would want to see that's different from any other kind of documentary, while still respecting the fact that this is very real information and information that ultimately we want to get out there in order that we can change the laws and end this drug war.
Yeah, I think you did a great job doing that. When I started watching it, I definitely was kind of like, okay, this is interesting, the different stages, this and that. And then it turned into something serious, and it kind of changed. Even, I wouldn't say changed my opinion totally, but I left it being like, huh, that's interesting. I mean, I kind of thought of it that way, but it had me thinking something different at the end. Like you said, you want to do it differently than you would see traditionally, and I think you guys did a great job doing that.
Thank you.
Quickly wondering how you get somebody like Woody Harrelson and Susan Sarandon and all these people to come on camera and kind of give their take on it. I'd imagine that's not an easy thing to do.
Those people are drug reform advocates. I mean, they have a history of speaking out about this particular topic. And so, you know, they were very forthcoming and wanted to speak about the issue. And then, of course, they were working associates, most of them of Adrian's. So it just made sense.
Well, that's great. So here's what we've learned. It's Goodfellas meets My Cousin Vinny. And if you love the love story of Henry and Karen Hill, you'll love this movie. No, but How to Make Money Selling Drugs. Matthew Cook, you're the best brother. Let me know which screening you're going to in L.A. I'll come on by. I want to come check it out.
Yeah. I'd love that. I can tell you right now, and so your audience can come join us if they can get tickets, and that's the 28th, and I'll be there, I think, at the 7:15 showing, and we'll do a little Q&A afterward.
Great.
And you can harass us with whatever new questions you want to come up with.
No, I'm not going to harass you. I'll be high as a kite for that. All right, brother. All right. I will see you then, and thank you so much, okay? Best of luck.
Thanks, Matthew. Pleasure.
All right. We'll talk soon. Thank you. That was Matthew Cook, How to Make Money Selling Drugs, which you can catch now on video on demand, iTunes, Amazon, I believe, as well. But it's also in select cities. I want to thank Neil Baer, who was on earlier as well. Under the Dome, you can catch Monday nights, 10-9 Central on CBS. Welcome home. And thank you, Taste Chicago, 603 North Hollywood Way. Joe Montana's show, Gun Stories, is on the Outdoor Channel. See premieres tonight. You could check that out. Thank you, Arlene and Joe Montana, for having us. Come on by. Have the mini deep dish pizza here at 603 North Hollywood Way. Burbank, Illinois, or Burbank, California. Illinois is where I'm. No, it's Well, we have a Burbank too in Illinois. Yeah, Burbank, California. But you got to get the mini deep dish. Trust me. And come on by, and we will see you next week. Adam Green and Stevie Ryan are joining us, and I will speak to you then. Have a good one.